Protest isn't a steady activity. It's a pattern of crests and troughs. Once the action committee's been constituted and its members have picked their teams, work must begin before the impetus is lost. The fundraising cell must get to work. The fund needs a precise objective. Something like briefing council or commissioning a survey of an alternative route or site. The precise total sum required must be stated, and it must be the maximum you think you can get. Too large, and you lose credibility at the start. Too small, and you've missed a golden opportunity. An expert friend of mine was horrified when at a public dinner to launch a national campaign, the organizer asked for $12,000. He was horrified because there was at least £250,000 sitting around the table. He could almost hear the minds clicking as the guests scaled down the checks that they'd come prepared to write. The fundraising cell should comprise members who span the whole income range of the people they will call on, and members should only call on people who are more or less their financial equals. Be prepared to name actual sums of money, and remember that the most common error is to make them too small. You must use tact, but firmness. Well, of course, any contribution is welcome, and we're grateful for all we get. On the other hand, it's no good pretending we've got much hope of reaching the target if people like us aren't prepared to go in for more than 10 or 20 quid. It would be absolutely marvellous if we felt we could call on you for £150, £100 now and £50 later, if we're in trouble. Remember the optician's advice to his son. Tell the customer, that'll be £50, sir. Pause for a fraction. If he doesn't flinch, say, for the frames, the lenses are another £50. Another pause, then each. The legal cell is there to make sure you don't miss any opportunity. You shouldn't expect them to win the war. Well, they might. It'd be wonderful if they do, because a technical legal victory is the best kind of victory. It saves a great deal of time, trouble, and acrimony. But their main value is more likely to be as a support arm to tell you how the game is played. Can you object? Can you force an inquiry? Is it possible to appeal? The legal cell should watch like hawks for any legal mistakes by the enemy, any technical errors that may invalidate documents, any ambiguity or slovenliness in phrasing which may be valuable later. The influential allies cell must start immediately on compiling the list of people and organizations who could be called on to help. In principle, the chairman should sign all these letters himself, though most of them will be drafted for him by the cell. They must find out something about the organization first, so that the letter can be seen as more than a tired routine circular. For instance, we feel we're the sort of people your founder had in mind when he gave his famous inaugural lecture in 1871. The expert cell is the most likely cell to win the battle outright. And the plan is its battlefield. It should put its best academic and theoretical thinkers on the task of attacking the enemy's concept. For instance, is the plan necessary at all? Will it solve the problem it sets out to solve or aggravate it? A doubt cast at this level is a very grave doubt. Moreover, this is likely to be one of the weakest points in the enemy case. It is probably that sketchily verified hunch on which the whole plan was initiated. Has the plan taken into account all the most advanced thinking, the most recent experience, the latest technologies? Have the Japanese developed a new cheap way of burying electricity cables? The field of inquiry is broad and fertile, and examples from foreign countries have a special glamour, as well as probably being unknown to the enemy and hard for them to verify. Is the plan comprehensive enough? Has it considered the needs of the area as a whole? Has it taken into account future plans for schools, hospitals, shopping precincts? Almost certainly it has not. It is probably the product of rather narrow thinking by a single department. Everyone knows how the same piece of road can be dug up 4 times in 4 weeks by the gas people, the water people, the highways people, the electricity people, and exactly the same thing happens all the way up. Is the plan based on unsound ideas or inadequate knowledge? Here, you must rally every academic you can get hold of. They should have a field day with any of the facts, assumptions, and influences that bear on their special subject. They can quote references and books and learned journals, some preferably in foreign languages, to prove that the plan springs from confused thinking and ignorance of the true facts, and is now 15 years out of date. It's been trouble enough for Sir Humphrey to make the published plan appear to stand up, but in order to dissemble its arbitrary nature, he has to appear to consider alternatives. If you can show that a good alternative has been wrongfully dismissed, you've opened a wide breach in the plan's defences. When the massive beaching plan was published by British Rail, a Cheshire schoolboy thought there was something funny about their figures for usage of the line behind his house. So he spent a day counting and found the line enormously busier than the report said. On investigation, it emerged that British Rail's survey had been conducted during the fortnight when the colliery that constantly used the line was closed for the summer holidays. There's no reason why a small army of lively scrutineers should not find that sort of hidden treasure. You must have your own architect's drawing. The great welter of plans are meaningless to the councillors who are not in the building business. They will pretend to give them serious study, but in fact, their judgment will be entirely swayed by the architect's drawing. It will be the usual idealized fairyland picture, one car on the road, one in the car park, 2 girls in summer dresses, bright sunny day, trees in full leaf, exaggerated perspective, and the building bright and shining in all its glory. You must get an architectus diaboli to do an equally accurate architect's drawing with bare trees under a leaden sky during the rush hour, cars jamming the foreground, washing hanging up, with the paintwork starting to peel and the white stonework staining to grey in patches after a season or two of exposure to car exhaust, acid rain and fog. Now yours is likely to be far more true to life. If you doubt it, contrast the architect's drawings of the National Theatre with the subsequent reality. Do a cost-benefit analysis. What does the community gain from the plan, and is it the best value for the money? A cost-benefit approach to the value of Ministry of Defence buildings in London showed that it would be cheaper to sell them all and billet the troops at Claridge's and at Dorchester. The expert cell has one further responsibility, and it's a vital one. They have to prepare the alternative plan. It's extremely hard to fight a purely negative campaign. Whereas, if you have a positive proposal, the whole case takes on a new complexion. The alternative plan will almost certainly be pooh-poohed by Sir Humphrey as impracticable or too expensive, because that is one of the conventions of the game. But as long as he cannot prove that it contains errors or betrays ignorance of the realities, your hopes of success begin to grow. And now to the publicity cell. Remember, the press, radio, and television are instinctively on your side. You speak for the mass of people who buy their papers and watch and listen to their programs, and you also save them from becoming passive recipients of official information. Public officials, however, are terrified of adverse publicity. It is one of the few ways in which their errors and miscalculations can be exposed to the public and brought to the attention of very senior people on whom they may one day depend for promotion. It's of enormous value if the leader of your publicity cell can have had practical experience of journalism, advertising, public relations, television or radio. But in the absence of a professional, find a teacher who's had experience of producing school plays. In your search for publicity, your best ally is the editor of the local paper. If he's prepared to support your cause, that's excellent. But it's sufficient if he remains impartial, so long as he gives enough space to your campaign. Detail your best letter writers to keep up an active campaign in the correspondence columns of the local press. Always react. Reply to any critical letters. Rebut any false allegations. Correct errors of fact. Expose misrepresentation. Comment on new developments. The worst error in publicity policy is to say, "We would do better to keep quiet." Never let your cause go by default. Tailor your stories to particular areas of the press. The popular press may enjoy the little old lady syndrome. Plucky 80-year-old widow forced to leave her home after 60 years. Television will always welcome the chance to leave the studio and get away from conventionally dressed middle-aged, middle-class pundits for a lively situation developing in front of the camera. Eccentrically dressed protesters talking with passion, unrehearsed demonstrations with unpredictable outcomes, mothers with babies and toddlers all go down very well. One word of warning. Your interests overlap with those of the press, but they're not identical. The bigger the row, the better, as far as they're concerned, but your aims are more precise and limited. You may not want to antagonize or directly criticize particular individuals or groups, but for them, it's all part of the fun. So warn everyone to react very carefully to questions like, "Would you say the council is being pig-headed?" Unless you want "The Pig-Headed Council Says Action Group" as the next morning's headline. It can take months of patient diplomacy to repair the damage of a monosyllabic reply. As soon as your strategy is in place, you are ready to do battle. The headquarters cell must get to work without delay. They must find out who the real enemies are. They must discover where the real power lies. Is the chairman of the planning committee the real force, or is he the cat's paw of the leader of the council? They must explore areas of disagreement about the plan. Do certain important people lack confidence in the costing? Are there jealous factions within the majority party? Is there a running battle between the town planning department and the surveyors department? The more natural gossips you have in headquarters, the better. See who your allies are. With a groundswell of support from councillors, a strong-looking legal case, and unenthusiastic officials, you may be able to go to the enemy in a position to negotiate terms at once. Never seek personal glory. If you create a situation where the defeat of the plan means everyone climbing down and admitting that you were right and they were wrong, you've landed yourself with a battle to the death. At this stage, give other people the chance to gain credit by sponsoring your cause, not merely to lose it by opposing you. So your use of the press should be highly conciliatory at this stage. Something like, "A very sensible speech by Councillor Niggle. We're delighted to see that the council are not rushing headlong into the plan." Or, "A most reassuring interview with Alderman Pompworthy. In some local authorities, this plan would already be a fait accompli and be jackbooted through. Thank heavens, our council has more democratic instincts. People are keeping their minds open till we all know a little bit more." The more people who feel they can actually enhance their reputations by opposing the plan, the better you have done your work. The only exception to this is the councillor with the genius for getting all the other councillors' backs up, especially in his own party. If you can arrange for the plan's implementation to be the cause he harnesses his case to, that is quite acceptable.